Thank you, boys. Good morning, everyone. So we're continuing our series this morning, looking at the encounters that different people had with Jesus. Now, throughout this series, we're looking to focus on how Jesus reacted and how he engaged with different people and different situations. Because when we look into the gospel accounts, Jesus didn't have a set formula. He didn't have a magic method. He didn't have a playbook. He adapted his approach to each and every individual. Okay, and as we'll see in due course, the reading for this morning details a seemingly chance meeting, though I don't believe there is ever such a thing, that resulted in a profound effect on the Samaritans of that region. Okay. Firstly, let's set the scene. When we get really reading into the Bible, there's loads of places mentioned, aren't there? Loads of names, and it gets really confusing, and often, because there's that many of them, and they don't have that great relevance to us initially, we can overlook them. But there's very often a significance behind them. And I always stick to the mantra, if it's mentioned in the text, there's a reason for it being in the text. It's there for a reason, so we need to look at these things. And this is no different. So before we actually get into the interaction between Jesus and this woman, I'd like to lay a little foundation and just address who these Samaritans were. These people inhabited a region within the borders of Israel, and it's located north of Jerusalem, but south of Galilee. So if you look at a map, it's like an elongated sort of triangle. What's the word I'm looking for? A four-sided thing that's like that, not a square. That's it, yes, thank you. Just checking you're all awake. It's like an elongated diamond. Jerusalem being sort of south, but central. Then Galilee is up towards the north of the country, and Samaria was like a band between the two of them. So Jesus has to go from the southern area of Jerusalem up to the northern area of the Galilee. Now originally, many of the ancestors of these Samaritans would have been part of the 12 tribes of Israel. I haven't noted it down here, but off the top of my head, I think it's Ephraim and Manasseh that inhabited, that were given that allocation. However, due to the idol worship that crept in to Israel at that time, God took away the protective hedge that kept the enemies of Israel out, and they were taken over. The Assyrians invaded the land. We find that in 2 Kings 17. Now, these Assyrians not only invaded the land and took away some of the people, but they also settled some of their own people into the land. And what happened is they intermingled and the peoples interbred. Okay. Now, what happened with this is that there was still a level of worship for Yahweh God, the one true God, but it was also intermingled with the gods of the Assyrians, and we had a sort of pantheistic rather than a monotheistic worldview occurring there. And the Samaritans had their own site of worship. They had a temple built on Mount Gerizim, which is close by, rather than going to the place in Jerusalem. Deuteronomy 16 says that Yahweh wants people to go and worship him, particularly the males, three times a year at the place of his choosing. It's pretty hard to argue that Jerusalem is not that place, but the Samaritans did. And as such, there was a lot of animosity because of these things between the Jews and the Samaritans. So that's the sort of backstory to where we are. So Jesus enters this region as he's travelling from Jerusalem up to the Galilee. And on his way, by chance, he drops on this woman and he strikes up a conversation. Now, to us, that's something and nothing. It's easily overlooked. But in itself, that is extraordinary. The culture of the time was different to our culture. Back then, a Jewish man could interact on a one-to-one basis with a member of his family that was female. His sister, his mother, something like that. There was no issue there. However, a Jewish male could interact with a female of his non-immediate family if there was a chaperone. I.e., there had to be a male representative on the side of the woman's family in order for them to talk face to face. It was absolutely unacceptable for a Jewish man culturally to talk to a woman on a one-to-one basis that he did not know. And we just heard in the reading that the boys read brilliantly that the Jews do not interact with the Samaritans. It tells us that in verse 9 of the reading. And there's some evidence, I can't say how authentic it is, it's not biblical, but there are extra-biblical sources that some rabbis write that they perceive the Samaritans to be so far as to be unclean. Okay. And it is absolutely unthinkable that a Jewish rabbi would talk to this Samaritan woman. Bear in mind, Jesus was considered a rabbi by many people. Obviously, he was a teacher. So these cultural boundaries that are in place don't have the same impact on us as it would to the original audience. But Jesus speaking to this woman would be so shocking, it would be to the point of appalling. That's how big an impact this would have been. According to the rules, Jesus was not family, he wasn't chaperoned, he was a Jew, he was a rabbi, and he was talking to this Samaritan woman. He shouldn't have been within a field's distance of this woman, but he sat down yards from her, talking away. And then we come to the woman herself. All we're actually told specifically is that she's getting some water. Now again, this is quite different today. We just tip up in the bathroom or the sink in the bathroom and just turn the tap and we got water. That was not the case. If you wanted water, you walked to the well and you carted it back. To carry water, you obviously need something to carry it in. Now, there were various items used back then as vessels. You could have glass or you could have an animal skin, but you'd have to be relatively well off to have the former, and you don't certainly need to have an amount of finance to afford a good skin, an animal skin. The other option would be a stone jar or a clay pot. Now, this would weigh several pounds, just the pot itself, plus water. A gallon of water weighs over 8 pounds in weight. So this is going to be heavy. It's going to be a physically demanding task. Let me ask you a question. When would you choose to do this? Would you choose to do it in the morning when it's cool? Would you do it in the evening when it's cool? Or would you do it in the blazing sun in the middle of the day?
I'm English, I'm doing blazing sun.
What's that phrase? Mad dogs and Englishmen. Go out in the midday sun. Everyone else with a modicum of sense, except for Mr. Davies. Would anyone else go out in the middle of the day on purpose?
No.
No. Neither would I. Anyone with any sense, Davies, won't go out in the midday sun. What does it tell us in the text? It says it was the sixth hour. The time is generally measured from sunrise, which is about 6 o'clock. She is out in the midday sun. I only know two people that are stupid enough to do that. One of them's in this room, we've just heard, but anyway. To everyone else, does it not strike you that that's quite an odd thing to be doing? Struck me as quite an odd thing to be doing. Something's not quite right there, isn't there? And there's something else. Why is this woman alone? Where are the other women? It says that this is Jacob's well. This is a big well. This is an important well. Loads of people would use this well. I'll tell you what I've concluded from this. Our woman is avoiding her peers. She's going to that well when she knows no one else is likely to be there. It tells us later on in the account, she's had multiple husbands and now she's living with a man she isn't married to. She was avoiding confrontation. So Jesus is not only meeting a Samaritan woman on a one-to-one basis, but even among her own people, this woman is an outcast. You see, before a word has been spoken here, isn't this interesting? Hardly a word said. There's no interaction started, but look at this backstory behind it and the details. I thought it was tremendous. So the stage is now set. Let's get into the interaction itself. I think there are various stages to this conversation. I'm just going to go through a few of them now. Okay. For a start, Adam is flippant. Verse 9, therefore the Samaritan woman said to him, how is it that you ask me for a drink? Since I'm a Samaritan woman. That's almost a taxi driver, isn't it? You're talking to me? You ain't talking to me? Chino, or is it the other one that does that? I get them mixed up. This woman is not backwards at coming forwards, is she? As we'd say around here. I can't say definitively, but I think it's reasonable to suppose that this woman's had a rough life. If she's been divorced 5 times, she's gone through repeated rejection. And bear in mind, culturally at that time, sisters ain't doing it for themselves. If she's no husband, she's financially struggling. You tend to find people who've been through the mill build up a wall. Maybe emotional, But they come with a hardness. They have like a protective mechanism. It's a learned reflex. It's a behavior. It's a defense mechanism, a deflection that protects them from the harshness that they're surrounded by. Then we get to the next stage of curiosity. Jesus responds to her, and it's not what she's expecting. She's not getting the rebuke that she's thinking she's expecting. She's expecting a mouthful. Look at verse 11 and 12. Look how the tone changes. She said to him, "Sir." We've gone from Al Pacino now to "Sir." "You have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep." Because of Jesus' reaction, the way that he's spoken back to her, we've gone from contempt, and we're now shifted into curious. Jesus has disarmed her by the way he reacted. His reaction was not what she was expecting. It took her by surprise. Then we get reasoning. Jesus talks to her about living water, and he then reveals to her aspects of her life that no stranger could ever have known. Verse 19, she replies, "Sir, I perceive you are a prophet." She's sharp, isn't she, this one? "I perceive you are a prophet." There's a bit of realization going on now. The pennies are dropping. And then we get to the final stage, which I believe is change. She's now looking for answers. She wants to know about the truth and worship. She wants to know, are we right at Mount Gerizim? Or are you guys right in Jerusalem? Which is it? Which is the right place? Who's right? But again, she doesn't get the answer she was expecting. Jesus tells her, geography is completely irrelevant now. Worship is now spirit and truth. There has to be one bit of Greek, Tony. You've done well. You've had 14 minutes with no Greek. The Greek word here is aletheia. And it's a truth that is based in reality, a truth based in sincerity, and a truth based in moral integrity. He's telling her it's not about ritual. It's not about physical things like circumcision. It's circumcision of the heart and living rightly. That's what he's saying to her. So the recluse now becomes a preacher. Verse 28 and 29. "So the woman left her water pot and went into the city, saying to the men, 'Come see a man who told me all the things I have done.'" This is not the Christ, is it? She's gone from self-imposed isolation from the very people who were potentially abusing her, and she's overcome the fears of her judgmental peers to go and proclaim things in the street. She's telling them, "I found Messiah." And that's something that many born-again people related to. I didn't realise it reading it, but when I started writing these down, putting the notes, I realised that pretty much sums up my coming to Christ. I was flippant. I knew evolution was right. I knew we're all here by chance. I knew the Big Bang happened. I knew that we are just random chance effects of mutation. Anyone who thinks otherwise is just a bit dim. Then there's curiosity. How come this lot are always happy? How come when I look into all these scientific facts, they don't add up? 2 + 2 does not make 73, but they're telling me 2 + 2 is 73. Then there's reasoning. Well, hang on, if that's right, but that isn't, but I look in here, and everything says the same thing, and it all adds up to things, and there's prophecies that can't be made up, and there's copies of these documents from the time based upon the writing styles, and they can't be made up, and these things have happened, and there's things been talked about that were in print 200 years ago, and we can see these books are still in existence, and things are happening now, and have done for the past 70, 80 years that are happening that you couldn't make up. Pennies drop. And then there's a change. The big mouth that was a critic, the big mouth is now the advocate. So, what's the application in all this to us? Let's get to the important bits. Well, there's bucketfuls of stuff here, isn't there? But I want to concentrate on just two things. I want to look at a lesson from the woman, and I'll quickly look at a lesson from Jesus. First, let's look at Jesus. This man, Jesus had every reason to give this woman the hairdryer treatment. He had every reason to give her both barrels. Think of some of the things that he could have chosen to take offence at. He could have taken offence at her lifestyle. She's living in sin, isn't she, in a time when that was absolutely unacceptable. He could have taken offence at the history of the people, how they had taken foreign idols into their culture. He could have taken offence at her attitude and lack of respect. the way that she spoke to him, and the complete disregard of the Samaritan people to obey the Mosaic command to go to Jerusalem 3 times a year. But he chose not to, and that is the key word, chose. He chose not to give her some grief. And this is not that Jesus is living up to this image that people have of him being some sort of perpetually grinning hippie. People think he walks around just smiling, hey, all is wonderful. No. You look at how Jesus reacts with hypocrites and liars. You look at how he responds to the money changers that were corrupt. You look at how he responds to the Pharisees. He gives them both barrels when they need it with righteous anger. But he's not in the presence of hypocrisy and lies here, is he? So instead of choosing to focus on the cultural boundaries that said, I can't really speak to you because of who I am and who you are, I'm choosing to overlook the history of your Samaritan people. I'm choosing to overlook your past and the things you've done. I'm choosing to overlook the attitude you've had towards me. I'm choosing to overlook the lifestyle that you're living. He chooses to see the woman herself. Just before worship this morning, Matt said about approaching things as children, didn't he? Coming to God. Children need help. Children aren't self-sufficient. Children need guidance, don't they? Instead of seeing the baggage this woman was carrying, Jesus chose to see this woman as a lost child. And in doing so, he saved not just the woman, but scores of Samaritans from the surrounding area. Now, we don't encounter necessarily people from Samaria, but we do encounter Samaritans to us, if you will. There's lots of people that irritate us. Just me then? No? Loads of people irritate me. But I have to love them. There are people that have a different worldview to us. Aren't there people who think that what we see as God is distorted? They distort their image of God to suit their lifestyle or their thoughts or their aims. We encounter people that from time to time, because of pride, we perceive they're beneath us. We also have history of people behind them. Something that someone has done has upset us. They did that to me. Why should I go to them? Or they stand for this. Why should I go to them? Or we also have people that have lifestyles that are completely at odds with what we believe. Is our response to be to put them right? Is our response to give them both barrels, to give them the hairdryer treatment? Sometimes, yes. But Jesus shifted the focus. Jesus didn't focus on what was around the person. He focused on the person. And we have to do the same. We have to discern, and it's not easy. When I get the hang of it, I'll tell you. Don't hold your breath. You have to discern how to respond to specific people, haven't we? Finally, let's have a look at a lesson from the woman. Now, no doubt this woman, I believe, had a fear of engaging with her peers. Peers that in all likelihood over the years, because of her lifestyle, because of her past, they shunned her. People that have despised her because of the way she's been treated and the way she's responded. They've no doubt mistreated her. They've no doubt mocked her. And in a way, they've caused her isolation, because she's come away from that to avoid the grief. All barriers that could have made her keep it just to herself. Yet following this encounter, this revelation with Messiah, she ran to the very people that isolated her to proclaim she's met the Messiah. Now the situations we find ourselves may be different, but the fear that she had is no different to the fear that we have. Fear is fear. It can be scary sharing our faith. It can be scary sharing it with your peers. It can be scary sharing it with your family. It can be scary with your work colleagues. I, for mine, think I'm cracked. Don't answer that. It can even be scary with complete strangers, can't it? We all find it difficult to share. And it's so easy to take that safe option, isn't it? You sort of convince yourself. You get to the point of saying, it's pointless for I even start this. Perhaps I shouldn't bother. Or I tell you what, I'm just going to wait for that perfect moment to arrive. It ain't never coming, folks. Or we have to wait till we have everything rehearsed down to the perfect T, because we're not ready just yet. I'll leave it for now. I'm currently reading a book by a guy called Greg Kuchel. He's an American apologist, and he has a great phrase in his book. He calls it putting a stone in their shoe. And by that, I mean he's given them a little irritation, a little reminder that sort of sticks with the person that you encounter, something that plays on their mind. We don't have to approach someone and give them this perfect, polished, reasoned argument. Just give them something to think about. And Greg Kuchel has another insight. He calls it gardening. When you encounter people, just do a bit of gardening. Just tidy up a little bit or something. Just a wayward viewpoint. Just give it a little tidy, just straighten it up. And the thing is, if enough gardening is done, then the harvest will be ready. It may not be us that do the harvesting, but if we do enough tidying, and if everyone chips in and does a bit of tidying, a bit of gardening, the harvest will be ready to take, won't it? And that's a biblical principle. Jesus only gave people tasters. He never blasted anyone with the full gospel. He gave them just enough to spark some interest, just enough to make them think. And here's the thing, why should we feel pressure to bludgeon people when Jesus himself didn't bludgeon people with it? So to conclude and finish then, just prior to this event, Jesus had an encounter with Nicodemus. And as Jeff has stated the other week, Nicodemus was about as high in Jewish society as you could get. Contrast that with this woman. She's not only a Samaritan, but she's the lowest of the Samaritan in her own society, the lowest of the law. And yet Jesus affords her the same audience as he did with Nicodemus. That's the beauty of this gospel of ours. It's open to anyone and everyone, irrespective of status, irrespective of your situations or your past. The only thing is we have to be willing to accept it. And it's our job to look past these situations and see the person, overcoming the fears and concentrate on just giving them enough, just a little taste, to put a stone in the shoe to set things in motion. Let's pray. Father God, we give you thanks that you give us opportunities to reach out to people in this world, Father. I pray as we come into these encounters, Father, you give us the strength to overcome the fears and you give us the words, Father, not to bludgeon people, not to force people, not to put them into a corner, Father, but just to give them enough to think about. And I pray also, Father, you give us the skills to do the gardening and in time for someone to come and reap the harvest. In the name of Yeshua, Jesus the Messiah, we give thanks and pray, Father. Amen.